It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A statewide grand jury is investigating Catholic dioceses across the Commonwealth for alleged sexual abuse of children by priests and others. The Department of Energy could provide economic relief to help coal and nuclear plants in Pennsylvania to keep them up and running. And we'll remember a Pittsburgh sports legend. But first, medical marijuana only became available in Pennsylvania 2 months ago, but the Secretary of Health has okayed recommendations to expand the program to include additional medical conditions that it can legally be used for and another form of the drug. Joining me to talk about these updates, Ryan Dito, reporter for Pittsburgh City Paper, which just last week devoted an entire issue of the paper to medical marijuana. Welcome back to the show, Ryan.
I'm glad to be here.
And also in studio is WESA's health and science reporter, Sarah Bowden. Hello, Sarah.
Hey, Kevin.
All right. Your comments and questions, of course, are welcome. Email them to confluence@wesa.fm or tweet us. Use the hashtag WESAConfluence. The change that garnered the most attention, the biggest reaction from patients, from opponents, was the addition of cannabis in leaf form to Pennsylvania shelves. Sarah, Ryan, why wasn't dry leaf marijuana included originally?
I think it freaked people out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's that simple.
It's that simple because right now the law is that you can't smoke it, but you can vape it. I don't see that changing anytime soon. Do you, Ryan?
I don't know. I think that they kind of got the recommendations pretty quick after.
Yeah.
But, you know, we'll see. I mean, I think I'm kind of on your side, too. Like, it seems like, no, we can't do that. But I think there's maybe a possibility. At least some of the advocates I've talked to say that they're like, pretty hopeful that it, like, could change. But I think vape is probably for here to
stay.
Yeah,
I think there needs to be some cultural shifts. But to answer your question why people were so freaked out, so you can vape the dried leaf marijuana, but you can also, like, technically smoke it, even though it's illegal. And so...
Well, what's this technically?
It seems hard to police.
Somebody's not showing up your house to see how you're using the dried leaf marijuana.
Right, but if you have paraphernalia, like, you could land up pretty serious criminal charge. You could lose your medical marijuana card. I don't know how they would catch you, but I mean,
right?
I guess it's not. Yeah.
Did the Secretary of Health Levine have to say that because she made that very, you know, pronouncement? And of course, you can only do this using.
She was pretty emphatic about it.
Yeah, I think it, and I think it kind of feeds into that cultural idea of what it is. It's like, well, we don't want people rolling joints, basically.
Yeah.
Like, we don't want people smoking bongs, out of bongs. So that kind of, you know, vape pen, something a little bit more civilized, I guess.
Also, several of my sources have pointed out that vaping it is healthier than smoking it.
That's true. Just like anything, you don't want to ingest direct hot smoke into your lungs. Vaping is a little bit cooler. It's a more technological process that a little bit cooler smoke that goes
yeah,
into
yeah, it's a lower burn point.
Yeah.
So. Okay. So medical marijuana already legal statewide in tinctures, pills, oils, and ointments, though regulations still forbid the residents from smoking it, as we've said, and also because it remains illegal under federal law.
Yep.
We have to point that out.
Yep.
So when will dry leaf be available at the state dispensaries?
I'm not sure. Do you know?
I heard this summer. So they're putting together some new code, correct? Like, that's going to come out next month. And then the grower processors have to create the product. So we can see it, I think, this summer. People are very excited. So I'm sure they want to get it out as soon as possible.
And it's also, it's one of the, like, you know, cheaper forms, you know,
yeah,
to get it in. I think that's, like, you know, part of it. It's, you know, it's more of a monetary thing than it is necessarily like a, you know, reefer madness thing.
Let's get to that because, Sarah, you were on this show when the first dispensaries opened, and I asked you about the cost of it, and to me it seemed pretty steep cost.
Yeah, and you can't use your insurance to pay for it, so all the costs are out of pocket.
So from the medical perspective, treating the pain, treating the conditions. Is there any research or even anecdotal information that the leaf form is more effective than the oils, the pills, the liquids? Do we know that yet?
Anecdotally, some of
anecdotally,
the, yeah, some of the people I've talked to say that they like really believe that ingesting, you know, the leaf in its in its total form is the best way to get the medicine. Instead of having the extraction process that is normally kind of okayed in really a lot of states now, of, you know, getting the CBD out for, you know, certain, you know, conditions. But a lot of people believe that ingesting the whole leaf all together all at once is more helpful, especially for, you know, pain and, you know, other things like that.
Also, it's what I've been told by sources is that the dried leaf is less concentrated in some cases than the pill. So you are actually getting more cannabis or cannabinoid
or, you know, THC or
with a pill or an oil than vaping it.
Yeah.
All right. Now, in addition to that, because I said that drew the most attention, but there's some other recommendations that were approved that do have quite a bit of an impact. I want to get to some of those new rules right now. And some of them will be good news to patients who were not included or their conditions were not included. What stands out to you first, Sarah?
Well, definitely the fact that pretty soon we'll be able, medical marijuana patients will be able to use the product for opioid reduction addictive substitution therapy. I think that that's really fascinating. There's some preliminary studies out there that say that it works pretty well and that obviously medical marijuana or marijuana in general is way less addictive than opioids. So, you know, I'm really curious if that could work and that could be part of the answer to our opioid problem.
Yeah, and Ryan, you did an entire report on this before this actual recommendation came out.
That's huge. Yes, exactly. Yeah, like really right before all these recommendations came out, I wrote this article about how medical marijuana could have an effect with the opioid crisis. And it's huge the fact that like now people who have addiction to opioids can now try to wean themselves off with, you know, medical marijuana. But also another really big thing that's kind of like flew under the radar was they lessened the, I guess, restriction for the term chronic pain. You know, so now it's just chronic or intractable pain is the only thing. It used to be chronic pain with a bunch of caveats about opioids, basically. Now it's just a broad, if you suffer from chronic pain, broad thing, you can qualify for medical marijuana. And that means people could maybe avoid using opioids past their acute pain. Like you might have a month of, you know, prescription opioids that you need after a surgery, say. But right after that, you can say, I don't want to take any more opioids. I'm still suffering from chronic pain. Let me have some medical marijuana.
Let me ask one more question about that, because they have in legislation to try to address the opioid crisis. They've been trying to reduce the number of days that prescriptions could be issued for the quote, legal painkillers, if you would. So could this work hand in hand, or is it still vague about that?
That's what proponents say. They say this can be 100% hand in hand. You get your first opioid, you know, prescription for your acute pain. Like if you have major shoulder surgery
or something
exactly, you're going to need that. You know, no medical marijuana proponents are saying get rid of it completely because you need that for the intense acute pain. But after that, like a month of treatment of that or a few weeks of treatment of that, you're still going to have some lingering pain sometimes. And instead of taking opioids, which can be addictive, as we've all seen in our state, it's one of the worst. I think Allegheny County is actually the worst for overdose deaths of any large county in the country. You can replace that chronic pain treatment with medical marijuana. And this could also have broader influence for anyone suffering from chronic pain. Anyone that has some kind of chronic pain that they can't describe, that they don't know how to treat it, that doctors are telling them, we don't know, they might have given them opioids to solve that. Now they can offer them medical marijuana.
Also, I think it's interesting that you hear some patients with chronic pain saying, you know, I'm having a really hard time functioning right now because I can't get my opioid prescription anymore, and they're not addicted, but they need it to function. But it's obviously still really dangerous to use opioids for a prolonged period of time. So it's, you know, this might help people who, like what you're saying, this might be a solution to that problem too. It
can kind of be like a stopgap, I guess, in between.
Is this idea of pain vague enough for, okay, the recommendations might even get more specific because doctors, I mean, is there any sense that doctors say, oh, what do you really mean? What's safe for us to prescribe or approve?
I talked to a doctor who operates out of the East End in Oakland. I mean, you know, in East Liberty. And you know, they don't, a lot of doctors don't want to prescribe opioids anymore because they see what's happening. So I think they, I think certain kind of doctors are open to using that kind of vague, you know, this is just chronic pain, we want to offer this. But there's still a lot in the medical community because, you know, medical marijuana doesn't have the testing that, you know, opioids have, that, you know, there's still a lot of convincing to do.
Because the opioids are legal, the marijuana at the federal level is not. So therefore, the testing is limited, correct?
Yeah, correct.
Okay. I want to get some other conditions other than pain. Palliative care. Why is that important?
Well, it's about treating the symptoms. That's what palliative care is. And so it's very related to pain.
Okay.
I'm not sure about
that. So that was interesting. But also other conditions, neurodegenerative diseases.
Yeah.
Are they going to keep looking at adding maybe or at least considering?
Well, it's interesting because there are already two neurodegenerative diseases on the list, Huntington's disease and Parkinson's. So now there's more types that it's more of a blanketed umbrella term. So, for example, types of dementia, you can now get a medical marijuana card. Prion diseases, medical marijuana card. So I think it's a little bit of a misnomer to say the list went from 17 conditions to 21 conditions. I think it's more fair to say, unless you want to count like every single neurodegenerative disease and every single type of epilepsy and every single type of autism, it's, I think they're broadening the categories is a better way to frame the way we're thinking about who can get a medical marijuana card now.
Yeah, they definitely seem to be broadening a lot of things. I also believe that you can get medical marijuana for cancer remission now as well, you know, in addition to just having cancer, like if you have, you know, effects from that. So, yeah, it's definitely a broader, much broader.
Just about a minute and a half left. What about the children and the pediatricians now have to be involved?
Yeah, so that's going to go in place, I believe, next year. So it's not going in place right away, but now if you want a medical marijuana prescription for your child, you have to go to a pediatrician starting next year.
And a lot of these conditions are the intractable, the seizures and all that, really led to the push for medical marijuana legalization.
Parent advocates were huge in this.
Absolutely.
Okay. So in our remaining minute, I want to ask you, first of all, the advisory panel that made the recommendations that were approved by the Secretary of Health, is their work done? Do they still have some jurisdiction? Will they keep considering it? How's the state going to keep an eye on how this is working and whether we need to change some things, you know, months down the line? Do we know?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm not sure. I know that the Medical Marijuana Advisory Board has not been disbanded. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw more conditions added in the not-so-distant future, and I'm sure that as more research comes out, I would hope that our state Department of Health would be looking at that science-based research.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to be slowing down anytime soon. I think there's already a push from some, you know, politicians to try to get
recreational, yeah.
Yes, exactly. Marijuana, you know, on the ballot or, you know, through the legislature. So I think there really is just a push to try to really just normalize all of this and broaden it out into maybe even push towards that.
Ryan Dito is a reporter for Pittsburgh City Paper. Sarah Bowden is WESA's health and science reporter. Thanks to both of you. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. He's being remembered as a legend, one of the greatest ambassadors for Pittsburgh, a champion, one of the strongest men in the world, a humble man. Bruno Sammartino died this week at age 82. We're going to talk about how a man who arrived in Pittsburgh from Italy well over 60 years ago as a skinny, sickly teenager became a sports celebrity known and loved around the world. Let's welcome former Pittsburgh Tribune reviewer, Pittsburgh Tribune Review reporter, Chris Tonieri. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you.
Bruno became the world wrestling champ in 1963, held the title for 8 years, lost it, won it back for another 3 years. Chris, you did your first story, I believe, on Bruno in 2010. Going into that, how much did you know about him?
I didn't know who Bruno Sammartino was.
Hold it. You didn't know who Bruno Sammartino was?
I had never heard of him.
All right. So what was your assignment and why at that time?
He was going back to his hometown in Italy, Pizzo Ferrato.
And he had never been there? Hadn't been back ever?
He had not been back, no.
Hmm.
And he was going back for the first time, and we wanted to do a short little story just about Bruno Sammartino going back to Italy. My first question to the editor was, who is Bruno Sammartino?
Did next, you get stares?
The eye roll is what
okay.
I got.
All right.
But they gave me a number of a restaurant in the North Hills and said, this person will hook you up. So I called this restaurant, and the owner of this Italian restaurant told me to come into the restaurant and talk to him. So we talked for about an hour, and that was when I first realized that I was being vetted as to whether or not I deserved to talk to Bruno.
All right, so then you got to talk to Bruno?
Not yet.
Okay.
First, I passed that test, and then I had to go to a lawyer in the North Hills named Marty Lazzaro. He vetted me as well. And then after passing that test, he hooked me up with Bruno, and I went to Bruno's house to do my first interview with him.
Okay, so it's not like Bruno had an entourage, but what were these friends that were just protective of him or what?
Yes, everyone loves Bruno, even people who don't know him love Bruno. But the people who are close to him, his inner circle, are very protective of him. He's a very special person, and they want to make sure that the people who he interacts with have good intentions.
All right, you pass the two tests from the restaurant owner, from the attorney. You get to Bruno's house. What was your first inkling then that this guy was a big deal?
You walk into his house, and he brings you into the living room, and there are photos of him with the Pope, photos of him with Joe DiMaggio, photos of him with all the most famous people from, you know, the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, Arnold Schwarzenegger, people like that. And you think, wow, this guy was a pretty big deal. And when you have pictures of yourself with Joe DiMaggio and the Pope hanging up in your living room, that's a pretty big deal.
I expect you do not.
I do not.
Okay.
No.
All right.
Yes.
So what were you talking about? I mean, you went into this about his trip back home. Were you talking all about his wrestling championship days, his famous foes, Gorilla Monsoon, Haystacks Calhoun, Killer Kowalski, or other parts of his life?
We started out, again, I thought this was going to be a very short story about him going to Italy. So we started talking about the trip to Italy. But the interview ended up being about 2 hours long. And I noticed that during the interview, he was reluctant to talk about his mother. Everything else that he talked about, from his career of selling out Madison Square Garden 187 times and lifting Haystacks Calhoun above his head, who weighed 640 pounds.
Thank you.
you know, all of that stuff was sort of rehearsed to a degree. Like, he's answered those questions before. It was the mom conversation, his mother, where he kept steering the conversation away. So I kept trying to steer it back. And the interesting thing about that interview was, by the end of it, it was dark. It was dark outside. It was November, late November, and it was snowing, and the room steadily got darker and darker, and he refused to turn on a light, and I couldn't figure out why, and it was kind of weird because I was sitting in a dark room with Bruno Sammartino, and then finally I realized why he wouldn't turn on the light, and it was because I got him to talk about his mom, and he started crying.
Yes, anybody that's gotten to know him, or reporters who have gotten a chance to report on him, know about just the closeness of his mother with his mother, because they arrived in the U.S. together. The father was already here prior to the war, actually,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly, yeah. And she, during World War II, when Nazi soldiers came into their town, she and everyone else in the village fled with Bruno to a mountaintop where they lived for 14 months in this secret refugee camp. And he got rheumatic fever, and she kept him alive by feeding him snow and wildflowers and putting leeches on his body to drain the bad blood. But she would also sneak back into town to try to steal rations from the house. And she once got shot by a Nazi soldier who caught her taking potatoes out of her own basement. So she did everything. She risked her life to make sure that he survived. And he never forgot that. He was always a mama's boy.
A mama's boy. You know, I think a lot of people would take exception to be calling a mama's boy. Do I get the right impression that Bruno might take that as an accolade because of his love for his mom?
Absolutely.
You couldn't say that to a guy that could lift 586 pounds, though.
To Bruno, you could.
Or to any other one.
To Bruno, you could. In fact, Bruno would probably tell you that he was a mama's boy. Everything that he did, it was all for his mother. He broke his neck in Madison Square Garden during one of his matches. And even though his doctor told him he had to be hospitalized, he didn't want his mom to find out from reporters. So he flew home with a broken neck and almost became paralyzed for life. But the only reason he did it was so that his mom didn't find out from reporters. That's how much he was always thinking about his mom.
All right. Chris, we have just about a minute and a half left. And I know you did your second story when he was actually inducted into the Wrestling Hall of Fame.
Right.
The word beloved has been used to describe Bruno. A couple of other Pittsburgh area athletes had wonderful careers during that sort of same time frame. I'm talking about Arnie Palmer, Roberto Clemente, both also gone now. Was Bruno as beloved, do you think, as they were? Are?
Yes. I think that if you look at the number of people that he touched, the number of people who loved him, he was probably the number one athlete in Pittsburgh history. Because
why did he touch them? Just because of his wrestling stature or beyond that?
Because Pittsburgh was a city of immigrants at the time. And Bruno Sammartino was this guy who everyone knew came to America as a sickly little boy, 83 pounds when he was 14 years old, spoke broken English, so he was the target of bullies. And he started lifting weights and through hard work became this icon, literally the strongest man in the world at one point. And the immigrant community loved him because they thought, here's a guy who came here as nothing and made himself the champion, the best in the world.
All right, less than 30 seconds. Is Bruno on your Mount Rushmore of Pittsburgh sports legends, athletes? And who's on there?
He's the first on the Mount Rushmore.
First?
Because if you consider the number of people that he affected, he wasn't just loved here. He was loved everywhere, in Italy, across the country.
Japan.
He touched more people than anyone else. The others, obviously, Clemente would be second on the list. I think Palmer would be third. And then I think the Chief and Mario would have to fight for the fourth.
All right, Art Rooney Sr., the founder of the Steelers. Chris, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Former Pittsburgh Tribune Review reporter Chris Tonieri. A statewide grand jury might soon wrap up an investigation into Catholic dioceses across Pennsylvania. That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. Posters around the city are urging people to contact the mayor and ask him to make "Won't You Be My Neighbor" the city's official song. Craig Tuchek has posted the flyers for the past year, hoping to gain momentum. And Pittsburgh got an F for its air quality. The American Lung Association's most recent report has Allegheny County failing across the board, one of only 10 in the country to rank so low. Find more online at WESA.FM.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Reports of sexual abuse of children by priests and others involved in the Catholic Church exploded in the 1980s and have continued into this century with findings of criminal behavior, but also shuffling of abusers from one parish to another. We're going to talk about what's turned into one of the nation's most sweeping abuse investigations, encompassing several dioceses in Pennsylvania, with Peter Smith, religion reporter with the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome back to the program, Peter.
Good to be here.
And on the line from Harrisburg is Evie DeJesus, reporter for Penn Live. Welcome, Evie.
Thank you for having me.
Your comments and questions are welcome. Email to confluence@wesa.fm or tweet us and use the hashtag WESAConfluence. All right. Grand jury investigations are intended to be secret, but what do we know about this panel? When did they start? How long is it, their term? Let's start with you, Evie, and then Peter.
This current grand jury panel was impaneled in the summer of 2016, July, and that was about 6 months after the Altoona Johnstown Diocese investigation report came out. So really about 18 months, the past 18 months, the grand jury has been looking into these allegations of clergy, sex abuse of children, as well as, and you know, imagine that the same things that we have, the things out of Philadelphia and these other dioceses that have been investigated, where investigators are looking into conspiracies and cover-ups and collusion and whatnot. So we are expecting the report to be issued any day, really as early as May. We expect it to be comprehensive. We are talking about six dioceses, really the statewide look, because we've already had investigations into Philadelphia, and we had in 2016 Altoona Johnstown, which were basically the last remaining six dioceses in the state. So it's going to be a pretty comprehensive report.
And Peter, what was the scope? Do we know what their charge was to investigate? What was the focus? Do we know that?
What we do know is that the Attorney General's office did subpoena documents from six dioceses related to their handling of sexual abuse, dating back to as far back as 1947, I believe. And the dioceses are Pittsburgh, Greensburg, Erie, Harrisburg, Allentown, Scranton.
And Evie mentioned the other two that they're not included in this because there had been investigations?
Well, we don't know. They might not address them as well. But what we do know is, you know, Philadelphia has been investigated two or three times by grand juries and with pretty shocking results. Most recently, there was Altoona Johnstown, which that's the smallest Catholic diocese in the state. And what they found there was more than 50 cases of priests and others associated with the church.
You said 50, right?
50.
Yeah.
Yes. And that's again, the smallest diocese. And not only were they accused of abuse, but also the report was quite scathing in how the bishops handled it, and also how public officials did not pursue cases as thoroughly, you know, law enforcement in past years as they could have.
Evie, what's been the response from the church in whether it's Harrisburg, where you're located, or other dioceses since the grand jury began, especially as we are approaching what we think will be when the report is released? Evie?
Well, we know that, for instance, the Erie Diocese preemptively released the names of priests who faced credible allegations. But really, Erie, as far as I know, has been the only one here in Pennsylvania to have done that. We were told that the Harrisburg Diocese had thought about doing the same thing back in 2016. But that they were told by the investigators to hold off at doing that. What you hear time and time again when you reach out to the different dioceses is that they are in full cooperation, that they have turned all the documents, all the, you know, any information and any document that has been requested, they have been in full cooperation. You know, and that you have to put that up against the historical context of an institution that has been historically so secretive, and that in other investigations, whether it was Boston or Philadelphia, we know that, you know, the church wasn't always forthcoming with the transparency and the, you know, providing the document. So that remains to be seen as to, you know, whether everything was put on the table.
Mm-hmm. Peter, you got reaction or comments from Bishop Zubik, the head of the Pittsburgh Catholic Diocese. What's been the reaction from Bishop Zubik and anyone else you talked to?
Bishop Zubik, he's cooperating. They've turned over any documents that would relate to the investigation. And what he says is he's hoping for a fair hearing and one that, as he put it, at least pays due to the context of the times. This is an investigation that's spanning 70 years. And obviously there have been different approaches. If you look at the current approach of the diocese, has been, you know, if a case comes forward, they announce it, they tell parishioners, they turn it over to law enforcement. That was not always the case.
Did law enforcement confirm or acknowledge cooperation?
Yes. The district attorney's office has said in the last, at least going back 20 years, that, yeah, this has been the pattern of cooperation.
That would have included then Bishop Worrell, who's now Cardinal Worrell, head of the Archdiocese in D.C.
Right. Now, again, this is going back 70 years, so there are we could be getting quite a history lesson here in the coming weeks.
Mm-hmm. Evie, a few of your pieces have focused on witnesses who testified before the grand jury, including a state representative from Berks County. He told you or your colleagues at Penn Live that he expects this report will be worse. Did he explain why?
Representative Mark Rossi, who is from Berks County and has become a very vocal and aggressive advocate for the reform of laws to reform the state's statute of limitations law. He put it up against the idea that we are talking about six dioceses, six very large geographical areas. We are talking about hundreds of thousands of parishioners. And whereas before we investigators had looked at the Archdiocese of Philadelphia, they looked at Altoona, Johnstown, so very specific and relatively contained areas. You're talking about a statewide investigation, and you're talking about decades and decades of allegations. And so, you multiply, you do the math, you look at the number of victims that, for instance, dialed into the victim's hotline that the Attorney General's office established immediately after the Altoona Johnstown report came out. They were flooded with calls from victims, reporting allegations of sex abuse by priests. So just really, it's just a calculation of maps. And I have spoken to attorneys, I'm sure Peter has as well, attorneys who have for years represented a victim. And they point to priests who have had hundreds of a victim. So again, it's just a math equation. If you multiply seven decades by hundreds of priests, you're talking about the potential of a staggering number of victims.
We have just a couple minutes.
That's what Rossi meant by that.
We have just 2 minutes left, Peter. You also talked to a victim's advocate. What was the sense you got?
They are, we'll know we'll know it when we see the report. They are predicting some pretty staggering results, though. They say that there's not been a report of this geographic spread in the United States that I'm aware of. Usually they've focused on specific dioceses. So they're going overseas to make comparisons to a royal commission in Australia, which looked not only at the Catholic Church but at other institutions serving youth, and they found, just a staggering amount of abuse.
Just 1 minute left. Can anything ultimately come out of this legally? Statute of limitations?
I think you'll find very few, if any, charges filed. There has been one indictment already of a priest in Greensburg. The Altoona Johnstown report, everything was too long ago for statutes of limitations for abuse itself, although two Franciscan superiors are facing trial shortly for allegedly failing to protect children from an abusive friar. What we may see, though, is a push to another legislative push to revise or lift statutes of limitations both in the criminal and the civil realm.
30 seconds, Evie. What will you be keeping your eye on as we learn more and more about this issue?
I think that this whole idea of what recourse does any of this provide to victims? Really, if the laws don't change, very little will come about. I mean, we saw this in Boston, huge case. And how many high-profile criminal convictions that we have out of Boston? Very few. I mean, we think of Geegan and Shanley as two priests who, were imprisoned for those crimes. But there's just been very few sort of, the legal ramifications that come out of these reports. So I think it's going forward. I think it, you know, what people, especially the victims, is what they want is where can we go from here? And as Peter says, a lot of these crimes, the statute of limitations have expired. So there's just very little legal recourse.
And very briefly, Peter, what are you going to keep your eye on?
To see if the victims and survivors themselves feel, even if charges aren't brought, will they feel a public vindication?
All right. Peter Smith is religion reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Evie DeJesus is a reporter for Penn Live. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Coming up, closed coal plants generally have features attractive to industrial site buyers, connections to rivers, pipelines, highways, and more. So why isn't more development taking off? That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, Pittsburgh baseball great Harold, a.k.a. Pie Trainer's jersey number, is retired in 1972. Trainer spent his entire career with the Pirates as a third baseman and was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame in 1948. After he retired in 1937, he became manager and scout for the Pirates and went on to be sports director of a local radio station. His uniform number was 20. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for April 20th, 2018.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Hundreds of coal-fired power plants across the nation have shut down in recent decades, including more than a couple in Pennsylvania. How are the companies who own these sites dealing with huge swaths of land that they don't need anymore? And to what lengths is one Ohio-based group going to save at least three nuclear plants serving Pennsylvania customers? Here to answer those questions and more, Reed Frazier, who's a reporter on this for State Impact Pennsylvania and NPR. Welcome back, Reed.
Hi, Kevin.
And on the line from Scranton is Laura Legere with the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Great to have you on the show, Laura.
Thanks for inviting me.
And you can join the conversation. Email your questions and comments, confluence@wesa.fm, or, of course, tweet us using the hashtag WESAConfluence. All right. Laura, Reed, several of your stories lately have focused on one company. Tell us about what's going on at First Energy. We'll start with Laura.
Well, First Energy for the last at least a year has said that it wants to get out of the business of generating power in competitive markets like Pennsylvania, where they aren't guaranteed to get a return on their investment like they would in a regulated utility. They've said that they won't be able to sell those plants, though, unless there's some kind of government policy that is guaranteed to support these coal and nuclear plants, because right now those plants are just having a very difficult time competing with lower-priced natural gas and renewable energy sources. So in the last few weeks, they've made a couple moves on this. They first announced that they would be closing three nuclear plants, two in Ohio and one in Pennsylvania, the Beaver Valley Station and Shippingport. And they also the next day sought a federal rescue effort to try to save not just their coal and nuclear plants, but the whole region's coal and nuclear plants. And then I believe the next week, they actually, this subsidiary, First Energy Solutions, filed for bankruptcy protection.
Reed?
Yeah, and in the bankruptcy filings, you kind of see why First Energy Solutions is in such big trouble. Just speaking for one plant, the Bruce Mansfield coal-fired power plant, which is the biggest coal plant in Pennsylvania, they revealed that they were losing on the order of $100 million a year at that one plant. And just to put it in context, the plant costs like $200 million to run, and they were only getting $100 million in income there. So basically, they were spending twice as much as what they were bringing in the last few years. And the reason that that's happening, of course, is because natural gas is so cheap. First Energy made a bet on these coal plants about 10 years ago, when the price of natural gas was high, and just right, just after that, the fracking boom came to this region, and now electricity just doesn't sell for as much as it used to.
All right, so they are appealing to the Trump administration, to the DOE secretary, which has been fairly friendly to the energy industry, for an emergency declaration to what? Get their customers to pay more?
Yeah, basically that's that's basically it. You basically said it. They're appealing under a they're asking Rick Perry, who's the Secretary of Energy, to declare it's called a 202C emergency.
All right, get through the government speak. What the heck does this do, and what's it supposed to be used for?
Basically, it's for times of war, or if there's a major natural disaster like a hurricane. It's been used, when lightning has knocked out a power plant, that kinds of thing, to keep power plants running, even when, you know, under normal conditions, they wouldn't, make money. So basically, the Trump administration is being asked, First Energy is asking the Trump administration to declare a grid emergency in this region, the Mid-Atlantic, so that coal and nuclear plants, like First Energy's, will be guaranteed, more money to make back the money that they're spending to keep these plants running.
I want to get both of your thoughts, but let's first hear from a gentleman by the name of Sam Walsh. Reed, you talked to him. I believe he worked in the Department of Energy in the Obama administration. And about the chances for this grid emergency declaration.
I think that they're really, really stretching it. You know, that is a very, very broad action that they're asking DOE to take.
All right. So have you heard similar reaction, Laura, Reed?
It's interesting, actually. There are people with very different positions that hate this idea, from free market proponents on the right to environmental groups on the left. The oil and gas industry doesn't like this idea. Major energy consumers don't, because it would cause their prices to rise. The regional grid operator even has said there's just no rationale for this kind of intervention because there's no emergency. They say that the argument is that losing coal and nuclear would make the grid unreliable, but they say, all of the evidence so far is that there's more than enough electricity being provided by other sources to keep the grid reliable and power flowing.
Yeah, and Laura brought this up, but one of the more interesting things about this situation is that there's so many different kinds of groups that hate this idea. When you get like the Sierra Club and the American Petroleum Institute on the same side of an issue, then something's up.
So in First Energy's appeal to the energy secretary, the corporation wrote that it deserves, quote, compensation commensurate with the value it provides to the nation. Is the company overselling, romanticizing its role in the U.S. power supply? Reed, then Laura.
So, one of the arguments that they're bringing up is that when you if all these coal and nuclear plants, not just First Energy's, but we get something like 60% of our energy from coal and nuclear, or probably a little less, but if all of these plants close, then we're going to have a reliability issue on the grid. The thing is we have processes in this country to ensure that First Energy doesn't make a decision to close a plant, and then next month we're getting blackouts in Pittsburgh. The PJM, which is the grid operator here, has to analyze every
Mid-Atlantic region, right?
Mid-Atlantic, technically it goes from basically Washington, D.C. to Chicago, but we're in the fairway of that region. So there are lots of government agencies and utility commissions and reliability. There's something called the North American Reliability Corporation. It gets very wonky and terrible in that way. But there's mechanisms out there to ensure that we're not going to have reliability issues if these plants close. But First Energy is arguing that, basically they're overlooking, you know, this threat to the grid.
Laura, has this situation occurred before, this direct appeal to the federal government that you know of?
Well, as Reid said earlier, this would be a really unusual application of this particular law. It generally is meant for a more standard definition of an emergency, you know, an act of war or a natural disaster. It's very similar, though, in its in their proposed result to something that Energy Secretary Rick Perry proposed last year, in that he was saying that any kind of power plant, and this would mean nuclear and coal, that can store its fuel on site for, in his case, I think he proposed 3 months. First Energy is now saying basically 1 month, that those plants should be compensated in some way, because simply storing the fuel means that they're more reliable. The argument there is that natural gas comes by pipeline. There are competing uses for natural gas as a heating source. So if there's a really cold day and a lot of natural gas is being sent to heat homes and businesses, prices will spike because it's also being used for electricity. They want to have basically a big old stockpile of coal to be able to have a secure fuel source.
Laura,
so the argument is similar in that way.
Mm-hmm. Laura, very briefly, in your piece for the PG, Turning the Lights Back On, you reported that since 2010, 11 area coal plants have closed. Very briefly, what happens to these sites once they're shut down?
Well, it's interesting because there's nothing on the federal level and usually not on the state or local level to require a power company to do anything with those sites once they're closed. And there's sort of a perverse incentive there for the companies not to do anything, because if they don't sell the sites or do anything with them, they don't have to know what all of their environmental liabilities, the contamination possibly under the sites, the asbestos in the power plants, they don't have to quantify that and they don't have to remediate it. So they have a reason to just sort of sit there and huddle. The State Economic Development Agency sees these sites as really promising for other kinds of development. They're really well connected to power. They're usually on rivers. They have roads and railways connected to them. They want to see these power plants transition to something useful again. So they're working right now to use some federal funding for coal communities to try to sell these plants, essentially make them marketable, disclose some of the things that might be issues, and try to come up with a promising future for those sites.
Okay, 1 minute left. If plants are closing in the third largest coal-producing state in the U.S., what does that mean for the future of coal nationally and potentially worldwide? Just a minute, Laura, then Reid.
You know, the future, it is tough for coal. We haven't talked about it, but it's not just a cost issue. It's also a climate issue. Coal produces a lot more of the heat-trapping carbon dioxide gases than other types of fuels, and it's clear that something has to happen soon to address climate change. Most of the solutions involve burning less coal.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we don't have an administration right now that sort of recognizes climate change as a threat, but an increasing number of Americans do. And, you know, on that note, we also have nuclear plants closing. And, you know, if natural gas is knocking nuclear plants off the grid, then that's actually not so great for, you know, carbon and climate issues.
All right. Reid Frazier joins us from State Impact, Pennsylvania. Laura Legere is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And finally, the May 15th primary is just weeks away, but state Republicans are still protesting. A new map which redefines the congressional districts. This week, the state Republican Party filed an open records request for any communication between Governor Wolf's office, National Democrats, and the state Supreme Court. State party chair said that the party is seeking any evidence that Democrats influenced the Supreme Court justices who imposed that new map after ruling the previous one as unconstitutional. And for this week, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together. On 90.5 WESA, the engineer, Tom Hurley. Research and production assistance from Zakiya Madyan. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.